history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories waiting to be told right there in your community. Usually, all it takes is a willingness to ask a few questions and, of course, the patience to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I trust that you've enjoyed this holiday season with your family. And if you haven't yet, make sure you pause to remember, and if you're so inclined, to pray for those men and women in uniform right now, all over the globe, putting their lives on the line for our country and our ideals. If you caught our last episode, you were introduced to Pearl Harbor survivor Mickey Ganich of San Leandro, California. At age 100, he's actually busier than I am, if you can believe that. If you missed the first part of our conversation, you can access the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also find a video of the moment a couple years ago when Mickey caused quite a bit of a stir at the White House.
Throughout the war, one great battle cry could be heard by American friends and foes alike. Remember Pearl Harbor. Have you heard that before a couple of times? Remember Pearl Harbor.
Remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet a foe. Just remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We shall always remember how they died for liberty. Just remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Yes. What can I say? Wow, that was good. He's a very shy person, too. And a great football player.
Boy, it's something to hear that rat-a-tat-tat of all those camera shutters. And Mickey was quite a football player, as the president said. In fact, he was supposed to be playing a football game on December 7th, 1941. In today's episode, we're going to hear about some of his experiences after Pearl Harbor on the battleship USS Pennsylvania, including a torpedo attack just days before the Japanese surrender that claimed the lives of 20 of his shipmates. Also, what he had to do during atomic bomb tests after World War II. What he enjoyed about returning to Hawaii for the 78th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor earlier this month. And of course, what's his secret to being so youthful, active, and prolific at the age of 100? But to set the stage for all of that, let's hear some excerpts of his memories of December 7th, 1941.
We were ready to play a game. We had a game. I was on the ship's football team, and I made the first team on. I wasn't very big. I was pretty big. I was 170 pounds there. I was big in those days. Now, if you're not 250, you're nothing there. So I joined the ship's football team, and we had a great team. And we scheduled to play USS Arizona for a fleet football championship, 1 o'clock, December 7, 1941. That was going to be the Super Bowl of the Navy. It was really important there. So we was going to do a little scrimmaging, get ready for the game, and leave the ship at 8 o'clock in the morning, December 7th. There was no place to change clothes. A little field was close by to us there. So we had all our padding on for the attack. When the attack came there, you go to your battle station. You don't have time to change clothes or anything. So up in the crow's nest, I went in my football uniform, all my padding on there, little trap door to get up there, pull myself through to get up there. That was my battle station. I was a lookout. Whether you're in port or not there, you go where your battle station is. We're going to leave the ship at 8 o'clock. It takes about 4 or 5 minutes get from the living compartment of the quartermaster's to get up on deck so we leave the ship at 8 o'clock. About 6 minutes to 8, the phone rang. I picked up the phone. One of the fellows on the deck was up on deck of our gang, called on and said, Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor. I said, oh, come on, let's not talk about it, because we'd been talking about it for months there, but we feared there was no chance for us. About that time, the ship shuddered. Some of our fellows that were close to the guns went to the guns and started shooting at the planes before we knew below decks knew what was going on. About that time, General Quarters went, "All hands man your battle stations. Now, get from there up to the poles there, what you, I guess you'd call it there, the mast there with the closeness, that's where I had to go." So by the time I got up there, ships were burning, planes were burning, planes were flying around there, looked close enough, you hit them with rocks, if you had anything to throw at them, I could have thrown my binoculars at them because I was a lookout, that was all I had up there. But by the time I got up there, just a few minutes time, because you're going and you're going double time or triple time, get up there in a hurry because you don't know what was going on. It was pretty hectic.
Yeah.
But I was well protected with all my padding on.
All your football pads.
Oh, yeah. A little trap door to get through there. Pull myself through with all the padding on. I couldn't go straight through. It wasn't that wide. So I pulled myself through with my trap door and get up there. And it was kind of bad looking, seeing planes coming all around you. And it got pretty rough. But the Japanese didn't know where we were the first attack that they had, because we weren't in our normal place. But evidently, some of the Japanese pilots reported to the aircraft carrier that there's a big ship in dry dock with two other destroyers. So the second attack, they hit us. Bomb missed me by 45 feet. Armor-piercing bomb, 500-pound bomb, came on past me. I'm out of course, and I said, came way down, exploded way below me. If it exploded on contact, I wouldn't be here talking to you. It's kind of scary to see a big hole alongside of you there.
So but if it had been a conventional bomb as opposed to armor-piercing, it would have gone off on the deck, and you would have been gonzo.
Yeah.
And as it stands, you're up on this crow's nest. So when that bomb detonates below deck, I'm sure that was quite an earthquake for you.
It really shook me, but we didn't know where it hit because if I saw the bomb coming, I probably died right there.
Again, if you want to hear a more extensive discussion of December 7th and Mickey Ganich's experiences there, pull up our last episode, number 607, at hometownheroesradio.com for that. We split up our talk with Mickey into two parts because this spirited centenarian had quite a bit more to say.
Your ship is kind of a microcosm or an epitome of the Navy as a whole, because here the Navy's been dealt this devastating blow on December 7th, and your ship was damaged and was going to need to get retooled for the war. So you limp back here to San Francisco, and as you said, they send you up to Attu and Kiska. What was the morale or the camaraderie aboard that ship after everything you guys had been through?
It was great. People, one, we can do something to fight back. And it wasn't really till the Aleutian Islands where we really were fighting back itself. We had a little bit of something there. The morale of the United States there was so bad there that happened that in April of 1942, they found a man by the name of Jimmy Doolittle. He was an aircraft colonel, and they devised a plan there to bomb Japan there bombers would take off of an aircraft carrier, bomb Japan, continue on to China where fuels were prepared for them. They did do it, and think about how big an aircraft carrier is, 800 to 900 feet long, and then the aircraft have to take off from it. They weren't going to land on it, but they were able to take off, but they did take off and did bomb Japan. It didn't do much damage, but they did two things. They helped the morale of the United States. We're finally doing something back. It wasn't really till that time that we did something fighting back itself. All we were doing was taking a beating out there.
Mm-hmm.
And also, besides bombing Japan, didn't do much damage. Japan figured they better do something, so they pulled some of their planes, some of their tanks, some of their men troops back to their mainland. And that meant less that we had to fight with when we took over the island. So it did those two things, help the morale of the United States. But everybody was jubilant when they heard that happened there. We're doing something. We're doing something. We'll get them.
Mm-hmm.
So it helped the morale of the United States. We up to that point. things were really bad. And then 2 months later, June of 1942, is when they had the Battle of Midway, the turning point of the war, where four of the six aircraft carriers that Japan used for the attack on Pearl Harbor, they only had four of them there at the Battle of Midway. All four of them were sunk. And as a result, their good pilots were gone. And that's when they got back, they're reverting back to kamikaze planes, kamikaze pilots. Planes and pilots were trained to take off but not worry too much about landing because they're not going to land. Most of them will die for the emperor. So the Battle of Midway, and just shortly after the attack by Jimmy Doolittle's group on Japan, those two things, that was a turning point from war. From then on, we were working our way, plus the fact there that the women were furnishing us with what we needed there, we were able to replace the ships and tanks and guns and planes and everything that were lost there, we were able to replace it. Japan was unable to do that.
Have you seen that, the new Midway movie that came out?
No, but I understand it's supposed to be good, and I plan on seeing it.
So you guys were up in the Aleutians while that was going on.
Yes.
And then you mentioned some of the other invasions you supported. What were your duties on the ship during all that time?
I'd start out as a lookout, but then I started getting training there for steering the ship. So I become quite an experienced steersman. In fact, they used me most of the time going in and out of port. I was a steersman, because I was the best one that they had. And I thought that was pretty good for a farm boy.
I don't think they ever taught you how to dodge torpedoes on the farm.
No. One experience that really had their invasion of the Philippines, the first invasion of the Philippines, a lady, Lady Golfer at the Philippines there, who had troops on land, fighting was going on there. Ships were in the harbor, some of them unloading troops, some of them unloading supplies and different things. And I'm steering this 33,000-ton battleship, because we're at battle stations there. Steering the ship all around there, a kamikaze plane got in there. This is daytime. It hit one of the destroyers, Avenue Reed. And we're all at battle stations, your torpedoes are armed. It set off her torpedoes coming out throughout the fleet. We got the word there, reporting a torpedo coming from that destroyer. Captain says, hard right rudder, steer for it, give it a small target as you can. Now, a car goes, when it turns, it goes right around the corner. Chip kind of goes this way like it. I look, see the weight coming from that torpedo coming at it. I got to hold a bar over here, and I got the rudder over hard as I can. Hold on, hold on, here it comes. It went right underneath us. Evidently there, when the torpedo was launched off of that destroyer, the ship was still enough, it went a little bit deeper. That's kind of scary. There's no place to run. Like you're driving the car down the street and you see a car come right at you. The way you can do it's kind of scary.
Yeah. So you're there bracing for impact.
Yes.
And you feel nothing.
Nothing.
And you're saying that's because this American destroyer was listing in the water, and that changed the angle.
That's the only thing I can explain.
That's a close enough call for me. And did I hear correctly that you actually saw through your binoculars that famous scene with MacArthur wading ashore?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I saw him wading ashore. That's the second time he tried first, and then he got other clothes. He had one look a little bit better, so he changed clothes, and then they took the pictures of him. And instead of his clothes all messed up, he had to look sharper for wading ashore. But then after that invasion there, then our guns went shoot straight. They sent us back to the States. We came back to Bethlehem Steel in San Francisco, get new guns. We missed Iwo Jima and Okinawa. That's the only invasions in the North Pacific my ship missed.
So and when you say our guns wouldn't shoot straight, because they'd been overused in the Philippines?
Yeah.
So they melted some of the barrels?
Yeah, some of the guns, we figured there they could do without us there while we came back to the States to get new guns. In fact, some of the guns we got were taken off of the USS Oklahoma. The one that rolled over inside, they took the guns off of it before they sold it for scrapper. And so we got some of her guns there. And use for ours, hers wasn't shot there very many times there. So Iwo Jima and Okinawa was back in our hands. Next step was invasion of Japan. So this is July of 1945. We're on our way back to Okinawa. Get ready with the fleet. Get ready for the invasion of Japan.
And we're going to stop things right there for now. When we come back, what happened to Mickey Gannich and the USS Pennsylvania just days before the Japanese surrendered? And also, what keeps him going at age 100? Find photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.